this whole stuff the best you've ever seen? Why the best?
Because it seemed to last 3/4 of an hour. Because it was done by Italian singers from the Scala. The tension of that Margot was absolutely, I mean, unbelievable. It seemed to come from some single center, which Toscanini was my absolute, my hero, in any case. You always had the illusion, this is it, it's inevitable, it comes from some center, it can't be otherwise. Because it could be, and Brendel doesn't like the records at all. I thought it too wonderful, because it was actually the combination of extreme tightness and tension with tremendous eloquence and ability. Falstaff was unbelievable. I'd never heard it before, and I didn't know what it was. And it's a difficult opera to hear for the first time. It absolutely bowled me over. I remember Cyril Connolly there.
Was Toscanini your hero before?
Yes, I'd heard him in London. I heard him, he came with the, I suppose he must have been the, well, the NBC Orchestra or something, to London in 33. I heard him in the Queen's Hall, it existed, doing the Beethoven's Symphonies.
Can you contrast him with someone like Walter? Can you specify what it was?
Yes,
about
I can.
Toscanini?
With Walter, it was too soft. It was. With Klemperer, I mean, Furtwängler was worshipped by Alfred and others. It was episodic. First, there came one long section. Then it somehow managed to reach an exquisite end. Then cranking up occurred. Once again, something started again. With Toscanini, it was continuous, irresistible, and completely dominated and hypnotized one. With Furtwängler, it was delicious, exquisite, extremely delicate, extremely beautiful, but always rising to some climax and then declining. Constant succession of hills and valleys. And no doubt in the score, there's going to be no hills and no valleys. The whole thing went from beginning to end. And absolutely, you see, completely irresistible manner. It is like a force of nature, really. And
it sounds that when you talk about Toscanini as if you're approving virtues that are not part of your own temperament.
Well, there's
something alien to you about Toscanini's
nervous
tension and drive.
No, I don't think so. I think the kind of writers I read are people like that. Turgenev is not a bit like that, I admit. No, I think the combination of purity, nobility, integrity, and tension are not the things I dislike most. I think my heroes are like that. Who are my heroes? Herzen was a bit like that. A lot of tension. A lot of tautness and tightness. I dare say Sakharov is a bit like that. He's now at the moment in Brighton.
Yes.
The combination of extreme humanity with inflexible qualities.
Which Toscanini had in.
Inflexible. You see. Thanks to his anti-Nazi, probably had something to do with it.
Helps.
Interferes with anti-Nazi. All that, you see, helps to see. Then he did Fidelio, which my friend Jasper Ridley was there with us, said, well, what did you think? Old-fashioned sublimity, he said. The phrase I always remembered. Old-fashioned sublimity. It's exactly what it was. It's the only thing I read about in books.
Yeah.
Marvelous. Yeah. Lotte Lehmann. Of course, was Fidelio, you see, and I can't remember who the others were. The tenor must have been, I don't know, probably Dermatas or some Austrian. Then he did the magic flute, not quite so well. And the man who sang Zarathustra was Kipnis, who was an Odessa Jew whom Hitler kept in Bayreuth.
Oh, really?
And he sang that. Yeah, did he leave?
Because there's a Kipnis who is a...
His son. Kipnis is a great bass.
Yes. Oh.
Alexander said, Alexander Kipnis? He was here. Kim Odessa. And I went to ask how I was going to interview. I must have known somebody. And he kept on sending notes to Toscanini, saying, look, with us, it's by uns, it's a field exam. But there are, he took the slightest notice of it. Not the slightest. Then I heard Toscanini, never again Salzburg. They were formative experiences. Falstaff, Fidelio. Search through the choruses, well, for nobility and grandeur, which I've never heard again, but the quick bits were fried through, as if they were routines. The Mozart, I mean, the quick bits are a little bit too rapidly done to somehow.
But was that then true of your experience of Toscanini generally, that he didn't have the same ear for Mozart, parts of Mozart? Mozart.
Fundamentally, Rossini and Verdi, and but in Beethoven also. When one heard it, one is completely, well, there it is.
Can you listen to the recordings again and recapture some of it?
Not quite. I've got the actual recording of Falstaff, done from the performance.
Oh, really?
Doesn't quite. The effect is not quite the same. I can remember not quite. And Stuart Hampshire was with me. I'll tell you the same.
Why do you think it was so formative?
Because I'd never heard anything like it before. Because conductors in England, ordinary English conductors, didn't do it that way. Because it was something fiery. Fiery and implacable. Which for some reason, absolutely fetched me. Completely captivated me. Yeah. You see?
And do you date your musical passion?
I think I like fieriness and implacability more than I like mere beauty. Mm. I think I do.
Because of the energy that it's
because
implied.
Of a moral quality. Because of some kind of dedication. Because of that. Dedication, which I think I'm rather more fetched by romantic quality than I am by sheer aestheticism. I think it's that. Well, then what was that in the year then? In 1937, I had Furtwängler for the Ninth Symphony. It was all right, of course, it was marvelous, but towards the end, it sounded like Richard Strauss. It was overdone. It was overdramatized. The last bars were totally modern, there was a lot of clashing of cymbals, tremendous beating. Toscanini I used to go to rehearsals of in New York during and after the war. I heard him do the Ninth Symphony 4 times. Rehearsals. Once in London, 3 times in America. Same thing always happened. First movement, he corrected it. Orchestra 3 or 4 times, but on the whole. In the second movement, he stopped at a particular place, about 14 bars in the beginning, and made the repeated endlessly. It was never any good. And he went and drove them off their heads by saying again and again, no, 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 begin, letter F, begin, hey, long word. I realized this happened every rehearsal I had, same place. Obviously, he had a vision. I mean, he had an image of what he wanted to hear, which could never be humanly done. And that's why the orchestra is pretty good, different orchestras.
Yeah.
Always something went wrong for him in that place. So in other words, he didn't respond to the orchestra at all. He had an inner vision, which is an inner vision of the
and
music,
he drove them towards
which had
it.
To be realized in some way. And some which could be done fairly easily, some which was impossible. I admired that, yes. And I think that was a man who was deeply dedicated, had a fiery vision before him. The others just plugged along, went along whatever they did. Now which meant, who else did I hear that? I had a marvelous performance by Michael Joseph Levine. It was Levine, really, spelt what we get here, L-H-E-V-I-N-N-E. That's the attempt to get away with it, in your Viennese sense. He lived in New York, was just a straight, a wonderful performance of Weber's Konzertstück. That made an impression. Wonderful pianist, I thought. Schnabel, of course, was my god in those years. In England, performance of Beethoven's sonatas made a permanent impression on me.
Yes, now that's the one part of, I've heard those recordings and I was tremendously impressed as a late teenager by them.
I've never heard anything like it. They were more serious. One learned a lot. They had a certain German didactic quality. One learned from them. And one learned from watching Toscanini, watching him alone.
What do you mean?
By his movements, which followed the music, didn't follow, but were, so to speak, coterminous with the music, which somehow, in some way, vividly illustrated it. The movements were not extravagant. Beecher is for ballet on the podium. Toscanini had these extremely dense movements, stopped exactly the right moment, moved exactly the right moment, when it carries on some kind of wings. I'm really watching them. Anyhow, I made a slave forever. These two men, of Toscanini and Schnabel, that altered my notion of how music would be done. While my contemporaries preferred Backhaus and Furtwängler.
Yes. And with Furtwängler, what you didn't like was the sense that he lacked a kind of continuous drive.
He looked like a radish. He looked like a radish. He had long, limp arms. Toscanini was a circus master. Yeah. Whipped. Yeah. It was all right in Wagner. It was obviously marvelous.
Yeah.
He had long, languid phrases.
Yes. But he needed crispness. He didn't
still
have.
Still, I had a performance by him in Oxford in 1946 of the Schubert C major symphony in Furtwängler. Beyond words, I disapproved of his sort of collaboration with Nazis. So I went to a concert with my wife and my mother-in-law, didn't clap. That was my punishment.
In 56, you mean, or in 46?
46.
46.
Just after the war.
Right.
He was dead by 56,
yes.
I think.
Yes.
Because the Minuit got into trouble with him.
I asked you because you said you went with your wife, and I think you meant...
No, but my wife, yes. My future wife.
Oh, right. Oh, yeah, I went for him.
You see, 47.
You didn't clap.
47 maybe it was.
Yes.
47, didn't clap. Maybe in 47. Yes. Didn't clap. Went, didn't clap. Wonderful performance.
Yeah.
Undeniably.
Do you feel that those musical experiences of the 30s have never been topped?
Yes, I do. Even Beecham before the war. Sometimes it's no good at all, and sometimes it's marvelous. Depends if it's naughty. Mm-hmm. Sometimes he was in the mood, in form, sometimes he didn't care. So it was up and down. I went into very poor things, but sometimes the Mozart glittered and shone. He was a man who, unleashed it, Toscanini suffered when he conducted. Didn't enjoy it. It was obvious he was on an altar. And when he said, the least good composer is a higher being, the best conductor, he meant it. Whereas Beach enjoyed himself and got pleasure from hearing the music, and a little piqûre of pleasure, little stabs. Fundamentally, I think he liked Massenet very much. Fundamentally, and so each little bit of Haydn, or each little bit of Grigri, even was terrifically enjoyable. And so it was for the audience. But it was sort of enjoyable. It wasn't too serious. It had a certain lightness, certain frivolity, like a very, very delicious light pudding.
But he never had the range for the darkness.
He could do Eroica very well, all the same.
Is it simply that you've got older and that those pleasures of
being one thinks that, but I don't think Kleiber today is the only conductor.
Who?
Kleiber in Munich. The only American reminds me of those conductors.
Oh, really?
As good as they.
Why? What is it about him?
Again, something miraculous, some kind of magical quality, which the music flows out in a kind of absolutely unstoppable, totally convincing man. If you heard him do Otello in London, quite different than anybody else. You grip one. So if I couldn't stop listening, one was in a state of continuous suppressed excitement beginning to end. He does it that way. His father came and did it not unlike that. Kleiber is like that. Karajan should be like that. And some people think he is. Not for me yet. Music is really the heart of my life.
Why is that?
Who can tell? Who can never tell?
Because it doesn't seem to have been in your childhood or in your early youth. What you seem to be describing is someone...
Yes, it was. Look.
But you're saying to me in 1931, 32.
Look, in 1916, 17, my mother, I told you.
Your mother sings.
That's why Carmen and Traviata and Rigoletto, which I, of course, revolted against in due course, and operas of that sort, and Trovatore, and Onegin, and Big Dam. And I don't know, Ambroise Thomas, what's his name? what is the heroine of Goethe's famous novel? It's the name of the opera. Mignon.
Mignon.
Nobody else. My mother saying, whoever sings Mignon now? Or Certain Mignon. And, or, I don't know, operas of bits of my bear. All that is part of my blood.
Yes.
All that enters my being.
Yes.
And that already created, when I was a boy at St. Paul's, 1923, 24, 25, I went to piano recital by myself in Notting Hill Gate on the Wigmore Street.
At the Wigmore Hall.
Hello. And enjoyed them at all Beethoven sonatas, all Schubert, all Chopin.
Did your mom have a good voice?
I went to the Queen's Hall for the promenade concerts, 3 nights a week, from St. Paul's. That is enough.
Then it's much further back than I thought.
Exactly. You see, Monday night, the Wagner night, I didn't go. Tuesday night, Mozart night. Wednesday night, I think probably Tutti Frutti. Thursday night, I don't know, Handel and Bach. Friday night, Beethoven. That's how it went. Saturday night, popular music.
Can I get you something to drink?
Well, every time I went to France with my family, Aix-les-Bains, to which I went every year, I went to concerts. Okay. So also in Marienbad.
Oh, yeah.
Baden-Baden, wherever they went, and I accompanied them. Thank you.
Did your mother have a good voice? Did you listen to her with pleasure?
With great pleasure. She had a thin, pretty, pure voice. And as I told you, she was taken on by Leipzig Korsakov, whom she wanted to study. Her father, who was a religious bigot, forbade it. She had no money, so she couldn't do it. Have something yourself.
I will.
For goodness sake. It is perfect, thank you. Most kind. I'll tell you a story. Arrival in England. 1920. We left Russia. In Russia I was taking the opera. I went to Mariinsky Theatre. First opera I was Bohem, which I don't remember.
In the Mariinsky.
Mariinsky. Second opera was Boris Godunov with Shalapin, of course. And I didn't really read it. I remember one thing I remembered. And that is, when he sees the ghost of the murdered Dmitri Shalapin, he went down on his knees. He said, "Choo, choo," move that gig goes on. And he climbed onto the table and he pulled the tablecloth over his head and he sang underneath the table. I like that. As a child.
Yes,
it was. Not I remembered. That's 1916.
Yeah.
I was 7. Then we came to England. That was 1920, early February. Went to Berlin, you see. We went to Riga in, I would say, September 19.
Mm-hmm.
Stayed there while my father was in England getting visas, getting fed, you know, getting a house for living, all that. And finally we were written for. We left Riga in early February. Stayed in Berlin for 2-3 days until the visa came through. We were Latvian citizens, and then we went. Some luggage was lost on the way. My mother became frantic. Everything, we had trunks supposed to be in the train, couldn't find them. She couldn't breathe, couldn't talk. I got into a state. Finally, thank God, we were found in Ostend. We crossed the ocean, but 4 hours I was pretty exhausted. Went downstairs, lay on some kind of mattress, slept. Then we arrived in England. My father met me. I rushed into his embrace in the office. I didn't ask for a passport. I remember that was quite civilized. I thought about it afterwards.
Yes,
my mother, of course,
yes,
had produced documents. I didn't. Then we were in a separate compartment of the train. We were in a private compartment with champagne. My mother thought it was extremely extravagant and complained. That very night, we went to Surbiton, where we were going to live. We arrived about 10:30 in the evening. I went to the piano and immediately played God Save the King with one finger.
Oh,
now,
my God.
That, what is it? That shows something.
Yes, absolutely.
My Anglomania remains.
Yeah.
I'm a very great admirer of England. English I'm not.
Yeah.
But Anglomania is.
Yeah. Where had you learned this? In Riga?
Well, of course, I'm sure. I must have learned it.
Yeah.
One way or another.
And did you play at all through... Did you
I took piano lessons.
Yeah.
But it didn't go.
Partly
my bad arm. But
yeah.
Partly which I could have had mended, except nobody. Such as a man the other day said to me, perfectly easy operation.
Yeah.
My arm would have been perfectly normal now. Yeah. It's too late.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody ever suggested it.
Yeah.
Still did its compensations. I couldn't take physical PT. I didn't have to play football. I couldn't fight in the army. I couldn't play the violin.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was my story about Serpent. And then I went to prepare for school. I could have spoken no English when I came.
Mm-hmm.
And I was given lessons in English by some English woman who lived in Russia, who I think lived there not far. After a fortnight of this, maybe more longer, 3 weeks, I went to school. And I spoke. And I was never persecuted. And I didn't do it. I was very well received by these little boys. I learned Cockney. I spoke with a strong Cockney accent. They were all children of tradesmen.
Yes.
And the like. And so
you learned in 3 weeks, in effect.
I learned enough to get on with. I learned more
while
I was at school.
Yes.
And towards the end of my time, which was in a year, I came top in English. It's a dreadful Jewish story. And also took part in Babes in the Wood. The second murder. Christmas play.
Oh, then you're thoroughly integrated.
And I could, the words I had to speak were, I'm a coming. Second murder. I'm a coming. And then I still remember that I had to say that.
Yes.
I didn't quite know why I had to say those words.
But you said them anyway, yes. Yeah. Very good. I'm interested why music...
It's the heart of my life. Mm-hmm. It really is. I remember Francis. I talked to Francis, what's his name, Haskell, the other day. And I said to him, I saw it somewhere. Somebody said that, by the war, that in order to save Venice or something, Fanetto would sacrifice 100 people, it would have to be done. I mean, sacrifice something immortal, object like Venice. I said, no, I wouldn't sacrifice a single life. Let Venice be ruined.
Really?
I saw Harold M. Nicholson's memoir that says it,
yeah,
quite firmly. Monstrous not to fight to preserve the... men can be replaced.
Yes.
Mm. Works of art never. That's the argument.
Yeah.
I said, no, there are two views about that, no? The idea of sacrificing human life for the sake of inanimate object, no.
Oh.
I'm not prepared. Two attitudes.
Yes.
Yeah. And then he said, all right, we're not all that interested in art. What about never, no more Schubert, Mozart, or Beethoven? Would you at least be prepared to sacrifice 50 people to that? I said, no. No, in principle, no.
Right.
If they perished, I wouldn't lament, maybe.
Yes.
But if I had to sign the death warrant, I couldn't.
Yes.
No more Mozart, no more Beethoven, never again.
Yes.
Even so, it's a very definite attitude. My friend Stuart Hampshire, same.
Hmm.
It's either you are. He thinks, quite genuinely, feel the opposite. But yeah, I could see it. There's
you think Stuart Hampshire would feel the opposite?
With, no, with me.
No, with you, I would have thought.
Francis, doubtful. Very surprised by saying this.
Yes.
I think he wants to save the art. 100 people alive or dead. Human beings are replaceable. There will be more humans.
Yes.
There'll never be another Piero della Francesca.
Yes.
It's very clear what the argument is.
Yes, but that just seems to me the weakness is a consequential reasoning. I mean, I couldn't see. I'd
you
be
wouldn't.
With you.
Of course you would.
And I'd only be with you simply because, I mean, in theory, yes. I think what that illustrates, though, is the kind of inhuman quality of some of our attachments.
Well,
I mean, there's a lot that's very inhuman about art and our attachment to it, but the the point is face to face with the person you have to pull the trigger against, then all bets
are
off.
Heath are very inhuman beings.
Sorry?
Heath Thetes are very inhuman beings.
Yes.
Intellectuals less, more human.
Yes. Although not human enough, I would have said.
I agree. Here's the thing is, then what happened? During the war, I was a very regular attendant of opera at Carnegie Hall in New York.
Yes.
In Washington, very little, because no music, you see.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I would listen to the radio.
What musical performances do you remember with particular pleasure after the war? Is there any period which is...
Callas, I remember.
Yes.
As everyone does.
Yes.
He did not have a marvelous voice, but a combination of dramatic quality and acting. Unbelievable.
I've only seen tapes of her in Tosca, for example. When
not
I really
films?
Yes, films on television.
Mm-hmm. That's good enough. Extraordinary. Callas was a phenomenon in the first order. Schlappin was certainly the greatest figure on stage I've ever seen, I think. Who else?
Both as an actor and as a singer.
Yes. Yes. Well, I couldn't distinguish one from the other. I'm trying to think what else was before the war. Toscanini again, conducted after the war.
Yes, we mustn't forget Argentina, the flamenco dancer. Now,
what? That's good.
Yes, we mustn't forget.
Mars. Okay. Before the war.
Before the war, yes.
After the war. After the war.
Let me ask you the question in a different way.
Schnabel again.
Schnabel.
Yeah, that was already from before the war. And what are the experiences? The skull. It's very meaningful, isn't it?
Have your musical preferences or interests changed over time, or were they formed very early as Mozart at the center of it?
Except for my revolt against horrible Italian opera, which afterwards came back in the most deep devotion to Verdi and to Rossini, which I...
Yes.
At the time, I couldn't listen to them. I thought, cheap, awful music.
Really?
Only Bach.
Really?
Only Beethoven.
Right.
Only Mozart. Only Haydn.
And now you've come back to...
Not only now, I mean. To already before the war.
Yes.
I returned.
Yes.
I loved them both. I never became Wagnerian. Yes. Never. I've always secretly regretted two men of genius who changed our history. For good. One is Karl Marx, the other is Wagner. Maybe we've been better without them.
Yes.
Genius is certainly well. From my point of view, they altered life for the worse. Not for the better.
Yes.
It's a terrible confession to make.
But that then, why Wagner particularly?
Because because I believe I'm personally addicted to there being rules. Music and morals and everything else. You can break them, but you must know what you're breaking. And that we mustn't do it too often. The thing was to come very near the breaking point without breaking. Like sort of people being unpleasant to each other within the discipline of civilized speech, not just shouting obscenities.
Yes.
You see? Mr. Wagner let loose the flood. After that, everything was possible. You see? Discipline in music disappeared. What possible? The doors were open in all directions. It's entirely, obviously, a very valuable, creative thing. Harim? You want to polterize. The point I had a feeling, you know, Timotheus. Timotheus was the man in ancient Greece who added four strings to this three-stringed lyre, maybe three strings to four-stringed lyre. That ruined the particular austere kind of music.
Yes.
Well, I think it really is a rationalization for the fact that I'm never lifted by it. I see that it's wonderful, remarkable, powerful, and so on. I've never entered into it. It's unfriendly. It's unsympathetic to me. The whole ethos of the ring. All these giants and all these kings, all this cruelty, brutality, and this real savage world. Is to me barbarous and menacing. I see that Nazis really did come out of it. And the sexual motif, well, Scruton is probably right, but never eroticism in my written work.
But also surely some turning back there from the full implications of romanticism as a doctrine.
Well,
I mean, if Wagner is the kind of
the super romantic, but I'm not particularly romantic. I think they're wonderful and they would change our taste, but in their extreme forms, they lead to fascism. Fascism in general, loosening all bonds, total chaos, anarchy, fascism, cruelty, violence, brutality, crush, total suppression of morality. That's what romanticism ends in. It ends in Walpurgisnacht. That's why Goethe was against it. I think it's a wonderful thing, because it is, if you want to interest me about romanticism, it's a big attack on what otherwise I would uncritically accept as being the right line, what all liberals do. But they discovered weaknesses in that, produced another set of images which are fascinating, remarkable, and speak to us. And now we're the children of both. And that's important. I didn't want to defend romanticism, say romantic is ever good, classical is ever dull. I mean, it is not my view. I believe in Kant and Austin and Aristotle empiricism and the analytic movement, not Heidegger and Nietzsche and all the rest of it. But I think the real anyone must expose oneself to it.
Yeah.
Otherwise, the fullness of experience. Fullness of experience doesn't have, isn't open to one.
But it's also true that there's no, doesn't, yes, you say you want to be open to experience, but you've also said on an earlier occasion that there's very little 20th century music that you can listen to with pleasure.
This
so
is
isn't
true.
It? Yeah. Isn't it the case that the,
I think that is.
The shutters have come down a bit?
I don't think I said that. What I said was that there's new music by a composer born in the 20th century which I would miss. I listen to some of it with pleasure, but not with dedication, not with devotion.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't move me. Poulenc, I listen with considerable pleasure. Some even Whitman. In Britain I admire. I think I don't like it very much. But I think Billy Budd is a kind of masterpiece. So he's turned the screw. No good to me. Unsympathetic.
Yeah.
But of that kind.
You admire it.
Yes.
Okay.
I admire Tippett.
Now, isn't Stravinsky a more difficult case?
Oh, no, because he's born in the 19th century.
Oh.
That's okay. And I love Regina Stravinsky, Bartok also.
Yeah.
Aline? I think it's mainly me. Aline? It's with Avon.
Really?
Avon probably made me furious with that.
About what?
About the joke. Why did Eden not let me go? What's that? Because I called him Sleeping Beauty and he made her with it.
Oh, yes, got it.
She received two letters and a telephone call saying I could have stabbed her with the heart. I thought you were a friend, she said.
Isn't that odd? Because my understanding of the Potsdam thing was that you felt hard done by.
I was.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, to say about him that he did it, that he was called a known as Sleeping Beauty, what I'd called him, that he did it for that reason.
Yeah.
Aline, anyone to say that Peter wants you to ring him?
Oh.
In his office. He rang when you were being done.
Sorry, I'm terribly thirsty, aren't you?
We've just been helping ourselves.
Drinking.
It's foully hot, isn't it?
Do you think so?
I thought it was.
I find it absolutely lovely. That's right. I mean, I know when it's too hot, but it's not that kind of. It's just air.
It's this cool New York City you're wearing. Do they have
to put
in
person?
I had a talk to Madame Sakharova this morning.
Okay, hello.
I talked.
No, is she a friend?
Yes, enough a difficult kind. A very demanding sort.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't really, by the way, I never saw her again, ever, and I always felt it.
Yeah.
She was never a friend, although she was a friend. I'll tell you, she He said, nobody could have said that to Antony. No foreign office would ever say, as Abba Ellen says, you're like the Sleeping Beauty. It's true enough. So you must have told the journalist that.
Yeah.
How could you?
Yeah. And is that true?
No. As the journalist said to me, he talked to William Hayter. He gave various accounts of why I wasn't sent to Potsdam. It was a terrible insult. One Hayter said, I really don't want chatterbox like Berlin telling everybody what we do here. But as I now met him, I said, how did you know it's chatterbox? Because I didn't quite believe that. And somebody else in the Foreign Office said, you just said like on first sight, just thought it was dreadful, very anti-Semitic, you know. And so he said, this man, the Foreign Office said about Eden.
Right.
Well, I thought this is the most harmless.
Of
the possibilities. Since the man knew that this removal of me from Potsdam had occurred.
Yes.
I've told you the story about that.
Yes.
I was summoned to London.
Yes.
All the way.
To do it?
To London to go to Potsdam.
Yes.
Suddenly I was told by the man in the Foreign Office, called David Scott and Fried, who had been going. I said, why not? He said, Mrs. Gibbs, who was looking after the arrangements, says there's no logis. I was rather stunned. I said, well, it may be true, but I can't tell anybody that, so nobody will believe that. There isn't a bed for me to sleep. Nobody will believe that. What am I to tell them? I don't mind. True or false, could you supply me with a story which I could tell?
Yeah.
I didn't know about Eden. And nobody told me that. And he said, well, Foreign Office is a very bad employer. It's very bad. You aren't going, but I said, well, I don't really mind. You say you don't really mind. Tomorrow, you'll mind like mad, he said. It's quite clever of him.
Yeah. And you did mind.
Well, then you see, of course I minded. I couldn't think why I was suddenly removed.
Right.
Delegation. I was meant to be the interpreter for Eden.
Yes.
Next day, soon, not next day, as soon as the government fell, it was the middle of Potsdam.
Yes.
Everybody in the Foreign Office who loathed Eden began telling me.
Yes.
Somebody said, Stalin doesn't like Latvians. Someone said, he just couldn't combat Dons. Somebody said, I can tell exactly what he said. And the Americans said, Sleeping Beauty. Because in the State Department, he became known as Sleeping Beauty.
Oh, really?
I said that to an American.
Oh, I see. You had started
I said it to Poland. I invented it.
Yeah.
I did say it. But I didn't say it to the journalist.
Yeah.
But he got round.
Got round. No.
And yeah, I'm very, very severe displeasure.
Yeah.
Middle lady of world compliment.
On other matters, I'm going to have to go in a minute, but I've received a letter from Henry Hardy.
Tell me. Who always writes at length?
Yes. Thank you. Thank you so much for your letter of 13 June, which was a pleasure to receive. It's good of you to explain so fully the nature of your sessions with Isaiah. I assume you only have one copy of the tapes. Do you think it might be possible to have copies made? I could store these if you...
Why?
So that two copies would be in different locations. Blah, 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 blah. I've always known there would be a biography, if not biographies. There should be one. We all want it to be as good as it can be. And none has... Over the years, various authors have been suggested, and none has evaded Isaiah's disapproval.
True.
I have even been driven to wonder whether I might attempt the task.
I thought that.
But I remained convinced that it is beyond my powers.
He's right.
Though I think I could make some contribution in a critical capacity.
Correct.
Your description of the prodigious task that faces any biographer seems to me entirely apt. Only Isaiah himself has the necessary range, and sadly he shuns the role of autobiographer. If you are the right person, I should be delighted and should help you in any way I could. Whether it is right for me to form a view on this question in Isaiah's lifetime, I am not sure. It seems to me that the right view for me to take is that if it's okay with Isaiah, it's okay with me.
That's good.
And it sounds from what you say as if that conditional may well be fulfilled. I have nothing that counts against you. Tell me what, if anything, you would like me to do next. If you want me to consult the other literary executors at this stage, I can certainly do so, but you might feel this was premature.
No point.
Excuse me. I have to confess I've not read your published work. I must do so.
must confess what?
I must confess I've not read your published work, meaning
quite,
my
quite.
Published work. I must do so. And then he writes a certain extremely amusing paragraph then follows in which he takes me to task for certain stylistic infelicities.
You.
My New York Review of Books piece, which is the only thing he's read. So I guess
which one? The,
no, the one
Jews?
Yeah, the Jews. He gives me a hard time about the Jews. Not terribly hard time.
I tell you what?
No, I'm not going to tell you what it is.
I long to what the corrections are, but I'm sure he's wrong, you're right. I'm sure.
No, it's too embarrassing.
Why not?
No.
It's not a bad one.
You can read the letter. The only point of mentioning these stylistic infelicities is as a way of saying that, in my view, a biography of Isaiah should aspire to emulate his own complete clarity and explicitness of expression. Would you agree? I certainly do. P.S. I think you are right that the copyright in the contents of the tapes will belong to the literary executors after Isaiah's death. Belongs to him now. But the physical tapes, of course, belong to you. So there we are. And I was going to reply and thank him for his letter.
Well, poor man, he obviously did think of himself as a biographer, but he won't do.
Mm.
He could help, because he knows he's been through my works
a
million times and performs wonderful services every day. I don't know where the text is. It takes 10 hours and finds a place.
Oh, yes, he's incredible.
Yeah, that's all. But the other people, who are the other executives? Irene, Brock, and Patrick Gardner. Patrick Gardner could talk about it in a shy way. Brock wouldn't be able to contribute much.
Yeah.
Sort of anecdotes about our work at Wolfson.
Yeah. He was your bursar.
He was number two.
Yes.
He was the vice president. He really was chief executive officer.
Yes. I wanted to get some letter from you at some point, at your leisure. And we could leave it for a while. But I would like a letter saying, because I may want to start at some point to go and talk to some of your friends.
So was the
see what kind of chat.
Right,
yeah. Or just say, so that they don't, so that I'm not coming to them on false pretenses.
I will do that. I will break the news to Gabby Curran, of course,
mm-hmm.
who's also been taking tapes, God knows.
Yes.
He also wants to write a book.
Yes.
That's his affair.
Yes. Well, does this give you a problem?
Does
he give Gabby Cohen a problem?
Don't mind, he does.
Mm. You sure?
Quite so. You can do it, he can't.
Mm.
He's what the Russians call polo-intelligent. Often intelligent.
Mm.
It's too amazing. Education in Israel is incomplete.
Mm.
He's not really capable of coping. My life in general. My Jewish aspects of it, Zionist, certainly.
Yes, very well.
He wants to write about his memoir, perfectly titled.
Well, I feel very unfit, so it will take a while. And it will take a while because I don't want to...
What will take a while?
Getting this a book of your life written. It will take a while.
Didn't begin in my lifetime. Probably will begin after I'm dead. Perspective a lot better.
Possibly.
Documents will turn up. We see there's an archive. The thing about Hardy is this. He wanted to my papers in order.
Mm.
He knows a lot of unpublished stuff,
as
he thinks might still be published.
Yeah.
But he realized that the quantity of stuff which he left to be filed is almost a real-time job.
Mm.
He thought, could he get a half-time job from the press and a half-time job from me, and I'd pay him. The press won't let him go on that, because rightly.
Mm.
He thinks that on a one-tenth part basis, he can't do it.
Mm.
That's frustrating and frightful.
Yes. Because there's so much stuff.
That's what he says. That I can't do.
Now, what honestly do you think? Is there lots more that you would?
Don't think so. He keeps on turning up bits and pieces. There's a long piece on Hama. No, I don't think it's worth publishing. But he and Michael Houseyer, who did the introduction, think it's certainly worth publishing. Mm-hmm. In that small book, it'll take me weeks to look through it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I have a great debt to any author. He's quirky, he's pedantic, he quarrels with people. He was removed from one job and switched on to another in the press, because probably the authors must have complained about excessive rudeness, stiffness. But he's a good fellow. He's like a quirky headmaster, son of a grandson of a famous headmaster, I think of Haileybury. And he's married to a rich wife. So our father's a chemist and chemist who got lots of royalties for some invention. He's not rich, but his wife has some money. But he hates the press, hates being there, would like to leave it. Mm-hmm. Hope to his hope, I might employ him full time.
And you won't?
No. Archivist? No. Mm-hmm. No. Pay me.
But you must have a vast correspondence.
No.
Is it filed? Is it in any kind of order?
No, it's in order.
It's chaos.
Not stolen. I told you the story.
Yes, I think you did, but tell me again.
Well, when suddenly in Sotheby's catalogue.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Well, who else? No, I think 500 letters may be taken away. But as they didn't have signatures, famous men, they said Tom, Jack, Jill. Straight away?
God. Nightmare. Were you able to get some of them back?
All of them. All three. Four letters.
With the famous signatures.
Dears Elliot, Bertrand Russell, Berenson, Einstein. Einstein's not written to me, but
about you. But Mrs. Utekin must have a very nicely, neatly filed, outgoing tray, doesn't it?
Not neatly, it's all stuffed. Oh, it's stuffed into some kind of... Yeah. I don't know what it is.